everybody. It is my great pleasure to introduce Nick Caldrey, who is our visiting researcher. We're delighted to be able to have him for another month or so.
2 months.
2 months, that's excellent. And he comes to us from the London School of Economics and Political Science, and did all of the great work of being a chair of the Media and Communication Department, and now has time to continue his writing because he is one of the most prolific writers in our field. So I think this is going, he's working on book 9 or 10, I don't even know anymore. I hate you. And we're really excited to have him here thinking about just fundamental questions about the compatibility of big data collection and democracy. You know, small topic. So with that, thank you very much for joining us, Nick.
Okay, thank you, Mary. It's great to be here. I'm having a great time in Microsoft. I recommend it to anyone watching this later on the online version. It's a good deal. It's a very good deal, and I'm very happy, and I won't want it to end. But I'll try and introduce you in 30, 35 minutes into some of the themes that I've been working on here. There'll be themes from a joint book that I'm writing with Ulysses Mejias for Stanford University Press. The provisional title is The Costs of Connection, but I'm sure it won't end up being called that. And I'm going to talk about what I call two problems that arise in thinking about the types of social order we're now living in the age of big data. And I use the word problem not in the sense of something we've got to fix right now, but in the sense of like the problem of free will in philosophy, something that we're going to be thinking about, puzzling about, all of us coming at from different directions, probably for generations. That's the scale of problem I think we're dealing with in relation to knowledge and freedom. And to get started, I just want to go back, particularly maybe you heard my whiteboard talk, it's about 6 weeks ago, you didn't, but anyway, to give you the starting point of how I approach social theory at all. So my broad interest is the relations between media, in a very broad sense, including information, data collection, everything we now compact into that word media, and communication generally, and something we might still want to call society, the social. I put it in scare quotes because I'm not assuming a neatly functioning order within national boundaries. That's absurd. Now, we're not talking about that. But we are talking about processes of ordering something like the social, so it feels social, which is called the social, and we're talking about the role in that ordering of media infrastructures in the broadest possible sense. And I think that's an issue for social theory, which is also an issue for economic theory, political theory. We all assume some minimal level of order without which we wouldn't be able to talk about any of the things we want to talk about in doing science, in doing social science. And I'm particularly interested in the consequences for social order, in this broad sense, of the fundamental, completely banal fact today, which is absolutely astonishing, which is the embedding of computing power, and therefore two-way or multi-way connection that's possible through computing power, at every point in space, and because information is archived at every point in space-time, creating utterly new types of feedback loops, which we have not even begun to theorize. That's the problem I'm interested in. And at the very least, that sort of deep embedding of computer power, power relations, if you like, creates new forms of dependence on computing systems, obviously, which are the basis of business models, new forms of social interdependence, and since no interdependence comes without tension, tensions, social tensions, which we need to seriously think about. And, if you like, also a new type of social complexity. How can we think about this multidimensional order that has to be arising somehow in the middle of all this change? That's the thing I'm interested in. And I just want to introduce from my previous book, The Mediated Construction of Reality, one concept that I think is useful. I won't refer back to it in detail later on, but it will give you a flavor of how I think about this sort of complexity. And I talked about it briefly in the whiteboard talk. And that's a concept from the German theorist often neglected now in Britain and the States, Norbert Elias, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany and lived a lot of his life in Britain, who developed a concept of social complexity which he called figurations. And figurations is interesting because it's very different from the concept we tend to rely on to understand complexity today, which is networks. Everyone understands a network, sets of nodes, physical links, or informational links, which create a more complex network space, maybe extremely complex. Now, Elias was also interested in networks, but he added a crucial ingredient, which is that they were dynamic, that they were lattice works of tensions. In other words, at each point in space, there's an entity that's pulling the entity at the other end of that line in the network. They're dynamic, and they're dynamic because there's meaning and content. There's something at stake in the network. That creates a totally different type of dynamic tension from the one we can theorize for the notion of networks, which is apparently our most advanced concept for complexity, but I think barely even gets going in thinking about complexity. He said the behavior of many separate people intermeshes. It's so like a fence, a wire fence, pulling to create the strength of the fence to form interwoven structures. I just want to illustrate that in a diagram. So here's from our book. You can see that's much more than a network, of course, because each entity is pulling on the other. It's not just linked, it's pulling. And of course, each person in the grouping, it could be a game of cards, a game of football, it could be a corporation, is being themselves pulled in multiple directions by other spaces in society. So in other words, already, even in this simple concept, and that's our version of Elias's diagram from the early 1970s, that's how advanced he was in his thinking about complexity, already that implies a multidimensional order, a tension in higher dimensions, which results from this apparently one-dimensional or two-dimensional plane, which is interesting. Just to go back a second, the question then is, taking his concept from the late 70s and actually already had the ideas in the early 30s, which makes it even more astonishing, how can we think about social order in higher dimensions, really higher dimensions, when we take account of all the institutions in society, what we call in that previous book, figurations of figurations? Well, here's a diagram of how that would look like. So you have the initial figuration, which already implies higher dimensions, but in itself, the overall push or tension or weight, if you like, of that figuration is itself being pulled by other institutional forces. So if we think about Facebook as an institution, as a figuration of figurations, the group of people designing policy in Facebook are human beings like the rest of us, doing their best to solve whatever they have to solve. And they have their own personal histories. But they're, of course, being pulled by the economic forces, which are the basis of the business model, which in turn is being pulled by the brand and all the social tensions that creates to represent Facebook in certain ways, which in turn is being pulled by government, law, and so on. Not ad infinitum, but on many, many dimensions. We're looking at hundreds of dimensions pulling together, creating an extremely complex type of order. So let's put that in the background and now think about two particular problems. But before I get on to my problems, just one more bit of introduction. We like to think, of course, particularly in media studies, which sometimes presents itself as studying what's right now, what's absolutely new. We like to think no one has ever thought about these problems before. But of course that's not true. The whole history of social theory has been puzzling at different moments of trying to say, what the hell is going on here? We don't have the concepts for this. This is what generated sociology in the first place. It's what generated the crisis in sociology in the 60s, and so on and so forth. So can we find any parallels for the sorts of radical transformations we're seeing today? Well, we can. There's a great book from the 80s, James Benninger's The Control Revolution, which you may not know if communications is your area, but I strongly recommend it because it's one of the very few books that starts out from the basis that communications, that sort of little area we look at through the lens of media studies, is actually the site where all sorts of other forces are being pulled. They happen to generate things like the telegraph system, newspapers. But that's because of all these intersecting forces that operate through them, that make them necessary, that sustain them, that generate crisis through them. So he sees communications at the side of an intersection of massive rat social and economic change, crossing areas such as transport, spatial organization, business. To give you the simple example from his book, which everyone quotes because it's so vivid, he explained that at a certain point, it was important to send the news down the railway line that a train was coming, because there only was one line. And what if a train was coming the other way? There were many accidents when the ability to send the message down the line and to do it in an ordered, precise way that was effective had not yet been planned and developed. That's a very simple way of how new transport possibilities require absolutely new communication in effective structures, which itself links into economics, business, and so on. So that's interesting. So can we think about today's problems as also what Benninger called problems of control? And just to throw in one other example, because it's an illustration of the sort of great conversations I'm having here in Microsoft, tomorrow in our reading group on radical social theory, we're discussing another great historical parallel, which will be Karl Polanyi's work, his book, The Great Transformation, which was on the emergence of markets in the early 19th century in industrial capitalism, and how that didn't just happen because markets were somehow natural and just waiting to be pulled out of the box. But the sorts of assumptions that make a market possible, oh, if I do that, you are of course going to do that in return, had to be socially constructed. They had to be built. And much of that building was very painful and difficult because it went against previous assumptions of the way the economy worked. So Polanyi is another example. But taking those two together, both of them bring out for me that even if your interest is economics, or let's say government, how the social is constructed, how it comes to be socially possible that human entities who could be doing other things interact that way, is enormously important. So I will want to argue that social theory, whether it's done well or badly, is potentially a very important contribution to economic theory, political theory, and government, and so on. So that's what I'm going to think about. So I want to move on now to what I'm calling the knowledge problem in the age of big data. I don't need to say any more about what big data is. It's in the popular discourse, and many of us in this room are experts in what it means in terms of the practices of collecting and processing data. And beyond that, the stories we're telling ourselves about the new types of knowledge we're getting of the social through big data. There's a lot of myth-making about what big data is doing to the social world. There's a lot of serious thinking about what big data could do to genuinely transform our knowledge of the social world. All that on top of the practices themselves. So let's think about this problem. What do I mean by the social? I'm always asked this, so I get this on the table right away. The social is not something I can neatly define because it cannot be neatly defined. But it's the word we use to point at that massive domain of human activity which is based in interactions and connections, without which we can't have anything like human life. We can have a few people existing in some way for a few hours or months in the desert and dying utterly wretched and unsuccessful, but anything recognizable as successful human life requires interaction, connection. And that's what we're pointing to when we use the word social. There is no better definition than I got that from William Sewell, the Chicago social theorist. But that's just the start of a few interesting questions when we think about this knowledge problem. Because social knowledge isn't just our knowledge of each other as individuals, that's essential, but it's the stories we tell about the social overall, because they're part of how we situate each of our lives. So we already get into a higher order problem: what is social knowledge? There's the meta problem, in other words, of how the social world knows itself at all. But not just in it, we have accounts of it, on the basis of which we say, you can't do that. That's unacceptable. or things can't work that way. I have a right, therefore, to challenge that. So social knowledge exists in various dimensions. And there's always a neglected level as well, which Pierre Bourdieu was one of the first people to point out in a book in the 70s. We forget that social science itself is knowledge, like all knowledge, has to be produced. Humans have to be in institutions very often. They have to travel to the right place. They need tools and so on. There's always the hidden social conditions of producing what we know about the social. And we need the sociology to understand that too. So there's many dimensions to how we come to know the social at all. And those dimensions are now changing. And there's a tendency always, which Bourdieu pointed out, to ignore those underlying conditions which shape what can be knowledge of the social. We assume we just know, we just see right in there. But that possibility of seeing right into things is itself socially produced, linked to various forms of expertise, privilege, institutional resource, and so on, which are really important, especially when that ability to see things is changing, as it is right now. And we can also think about how the knowledge of those conditions under which social knowledge is produced is deliberately made opaque very often. We don't always want people to see into the engine room, to see how we claim to see the world, because that would lead to challenge. And I think we're in a stage where certain things are very opaque about the new types of knowledge. So I want to come on to that. Now, this is where I think historical comparison becomes really useful, because, and I've been working on this a lot while I've been here, because if we just start off from what we have now, it's bewildering, very fast, changing, and therefore the natural thing is to say, well, let's go with those who are doing the work and follow what they say. But then we have no historical comparison at all. We have no sense of whether previous societies have gone through similar things, and if they have, did it work out radically differently? And that's what I want to suggest to you for a few minutes, that the comparison with the 19th century to early 20th century leads to some very surprising differences from where we are today. I won't go into the detail of the history of statistics. It's not my expertise, but I've been reading a lot of the books by those who are experts, and it throws up some very interesting differences. So in the early 19th century, late 18th century, there was a radical shift in the knowledge of the social, particularly in Europe and North America. So the world shifted from one in which there was human nature, which was largely fixed and written about from Aristotle. And there was human variation. Individuals were, of course, slightly varied. But we didn't know much about that, and therefore it wasn't very interesting, and nothing ordered or structured could be said about it. That was all there was. So there wasn't really much of a development of social science. Statistics, based on counting, gathering data, counting, starting to observe numerical and statistical patterns, radically changed what could be said about the social, and many would argue actually created the possibility of a social, of the idea there was something ordered out there which was the social. And this was a complex social and, of course, highly political process. As Ted Porter, one of the leading historians of numbers, statistics, writes, the credibility of numbers doesn't just exist, it's a social and moral problem. People fight over which numbers are better, who has the right to generate numbers and apply them to the world. Power must be exercised in a variety of ways to make the measurements and tallies valid. Well, I think it's pretty obvious. We're in such a moment of history right now. There's a massive battle going on about the measurements and the tallies. And he also says that when a power game is won and certain measurements and tallies become normative, they are very effective in changing the world in certain ways. Or as Ian Hacking puts it in another great book, ways of making up people. Making people who can now be talked about in new ways. And without going into any detail, those of you in economics will obviously know the history was the emergence of extraordinary new ideas of the average, the normal person, around which statistical variation always tended to vary. This was an extraordinary concept, the statistical norm. And that was based in very material tools, putting data together in packages that could be then talked about as one thing. The idea of the map, which had data encoded into it. A great example, because I see if I walk around the geography department at LSE, they still have it on the walls, is Charles Booth's map of London poverty, based on his discovery of 8 dimensions of poverty which came out of statistical analysis. And it was put up on the wall and all sorts of institutes, so we can think about how London is organized. Some recent, interesting recent history by Dan Balker, historian of the insurance industry on this, which is very parallel to what we're going through today, the emergence of new data aggregates. So that's, if you like, in a snapshot, what Alain de Rozier, another writer about statistics, calls the concrete history of abstraction. Abstraction doesn't just come from nowhere, it has to be built. In particular, resources. It's hard to speak abstractly and get it to stick on the world. So what are the parallels today? Well, just to sum up what my argument's going to be, and I'll go through some more detail in a moment, I think today's massive explosion of social knowledge through big data has 2 very distinctive features compared with the 19th century. The first is the depth, almost infinite depth, and the continuity, the absolute continuity of which data is collected. This has no parallel in the 19th century. There were censuses every 10 years. There were various other tools to gather data wherever you could, put it together somehow. There was nothing remotely similar to the depth and continuity we now take for granted. And secondly, who's gathering the data? Who controls the data? On what terms? As we'll see, it's very different today from the way it was in the 19th century. So just going a bit more detail. The point about continuity, as I said, data in the 19th century was gathered episodically. Therefore, there was no N equals all. N equals all was unimaginable. N was relatively small. It might include the whole country if you could compel people to fill in the census, but that was only every 10 years. And the gap in between was not known. Insurance companies tried to do better than that, but there were limits to what they could do. The key point, though, I think, is that social knowledge today is increasingly generated by private capacities. I call them capacities because it's not just corporations. Any business that starts up today almost certainly has in its business model creating a platform with apps, linked to apps and APIs to gather data, either for its own purposes or to sell that data on or to somehow make itself valuable to other corporations because it has that data. So the collection of data is built into almost any business model today, any private business model. States and publics are also involved, but most of the data is privately gathered, and that's important. It's also important that this, we're not just talking about capacities, we're talking about the values which govern the collection of data. I was struck in Ted Porter's book, he discusses a debate in the 19th century in France, where there was the Statistical Association of France, which said the reason we need statistics is to defend public values against private values. If we get a picture of the whole, which we can through statistics, then we can answer the private interests who want to dominate society one way or the other. I think it's obvious that that is radically different from the official goals of collection of data today, although there are exceptions, which I'll come back to. Another key point is the opacity of gathering knowledge today. I'm sure there are many things which remain to obscure to people about the statistics in the 19th century, obviously. But in broad terms, these were information that was gathered publicly through public means and was able open to public debate. So insurers had a few means on the basis of which they wrote the premiums for people wanting insurance policies. And when it became obviously known that they gave different premiums to black people versus white people, it wasn't a very difficult inference to say their race had something to do with it. And there were fierce contests in the United States about that. There were not so many variables involved. Today, there are disputes about these things, but as we know, it's not so easy to challenge why, in a particular way, an algorithm has presented this in your newsfeed today and presented that in your newsfeed yesterday. Also, this led to very interesting new debates about things which are inherently public. What is poverty? That was a notion that emerged out of gathering various statistical information, aggregating it, to talk about a new thing, poverty, as something which was socially determined, socially shaped, not just down to fate, not just curable by charity, something that could socially be attacked because it was understood statistically. That is very, and that produced public debates about the outputs of data, which is very different, I think, from what Frank Pasquale in his recent book talks of as the generation of data behind the sort of one-way mirror. I talked about Booth's poverty map before. And of course we know that although in the past too, data was used to discriminate against people, of course, there was also the main emphasis was on social generalizations, trying to understand society itself. That goes on today. But as we know, the principal purpose of data collection today is to make differentiations, as data always does, and to do it to change the actions which corporations can take, which is to discriminate, discriminating particularities. It's true that some of the people in the marketing industry and the data industry will tell you something different. That's a quote from a recent book on the marketing industry, that the truth very soon will be present in everything. If we're all wearing devices which are measuring everything about us, communicating with other things, the truth will be right there, easily accessible. You'll know everything about yourself and your loved ones if you opt in. Actually, I think that's a very misleading view about the development. Actually, we're talking about much more particular stories today. And I think it's interesting, again, we go back to the public-private thing. If you know anything about 19th century and statistics, one of the key debates at that time in the public realm, it even reached Charles Dickens' novel Hard Times, was the question of freedom. If it was true there was an average man, as they called it, a statistical norm, where was free will? Some people argued that there was no free will, that we were condemned just to play out the average, just in our particular bodies. Others argue fiercely that the individual remained free. We were just talking a statistical pattern at the general level. This was one of the biggest debates about statistics, which was about one of the fundamental questions in philosophy, free will. I don't yet see debates about the significance of big data on that philosophical or normative level, but those were normal in the 19th century, and that's an interesting difference. But it leads to another point about what I call conditionality. Of course, the state could compel you to answer a census in a way, in the sense we're compelled to give in certain information when we want to join a platform. But I think the conditionality was different. As I said, this was much less frequent, the gathering of data. And also, it's now part of an individual deal we all do to get access to a platform, type of information. We just have to give a certain amount of information and we consent to certain terms and conditions. It's almost a very pervasive conditionality that's extremely hard to opt out of and that has consequences for right across our lives in a way that the gathering of data by the 19th century state did not, because the state was much weaker. That's the general comparison. Let's just move on to the sort of questions that emerge into what I'm calling the problem of knowledge today. The first sort of thing is, which I can't answer, of course, because no one can yet, is what sort of social will this new model of social knowledge production, what sort of social will it produce in the long run? Will there be a parallel to what we had in the 19th century that will invent a totally new concept, like poverty, to radically see into the social world, change the politics of the social? Well, with so many sources of knowledge in private hands, I'm not seeing many signs of that yet. It is a valid question. We don't know what sort of social will be generated, but we can be sure a different social will be generated from this very new type of social knowledge. That raises questions of legitimacy, which are again unfathomable. no social knowledge can be generated and be effective unless people trust it and people trust and respect the authority of those gathering the data to do so and the way they use categorizations. There are a lot of disputes about the way certain algorithms work right now, particularly in US politics. We don't know the consequences of those for the legitimacy of algorithmic knowledge generally. But it's a serious question we have to think about if we think about all of this from a social point of view. Third question is this really social knowledge at all? Something that strikes me, I'm officially a social theorist, whatever that is, but then I often think, well, Mark Zuckerberg is the highest paid social theorist in the world, and I'm never going to get close to his rewards, because the branding of Facebook is based around social theoretical claims. There's a whole website where Zuckerberg's very interesting and in many ways impressive and rich comments on what Facebook is trying to do is gathered there. And here's one particular one where he said that, I think this was around 2010 when they were developing the social graph and developing that to a higher level, he said, we believe that eventually almost all apps you use are going to be social. But in the world, that's the social world, I guess, there's a natural spectrum from behaviors that are really naturally social to ones that aren't. And the ones that are naturally social are going to be the ones that turn into social apps. So it's somehow, if there's an app for it, then it's naturally social. But he's also saying we're engineering this, otherwise it wouldn't happen. So you see there's a very strange sort of bifurcated reasoning here, which is necessary for the brand that has to talk about the social. I'm going to rush a bit here because I want to get on to another problem. There are some ethical problems here. A lot of data is used to modulate behavior. There are some signs now developing, there was a big Guardian article recently, about those within the data industry who are becoming a little worried about this. You may have heard of B.J. Fogg, the Stanford data scientist, his science of captology, which is gathering data at a micro level about people in order to seriously influence their behavior, to nudge them regularly, so much so that they never forget the nudge, and they, like a ball in a pinball machine, will regularly achieve certain ends. But Tristan Harris, who worked with him originally, raises this question in the magazine that's published by The Economist. What responsibility comes with the ability to influence the psychology of a billion people? Where's the Hippocratic Oath? I mean, do we have an ethics of this influence on this scale? Which raises another issue about the ethics of the gathering of the data. Should there be apps for everything? The principle of N equals all, of big data, that you must have as much data as possible on every conceivable dimension to bring it together, to allow the computing to take place, hits against basic ethical questions. Should we have an app for whether I'm truly grieving my mother? Or whether I'm really in love with this person? Are we already stepping into territory which is beyond unacceptable? And if so, why? Why is that unacceptable? Are we clear about why? Well, are there questions of intimacy which we would not allow data collection to get into? We don't know the answer to this. So I'm just raising these as questions. And this takes me to the second big problem, which I will try and deal with in 5 minutes to allow for broader questions, which is the problem of freedom. Obviously, big data depends on continuous tracking of people. I don't need to elaborate that point. Kevin Kelly, the West Coast tech evangelist, says in his new book, The Inevitable, that tracking is just one of those 12 dimensions of everything that is now inevitable and will constitute the new world. I think there's a problem with this because what he never talks about is that tracking is not just a technical possibility. It's a social process. As all social knowledge production is social. The Economist, World Economic Forum, and others talk about social data, all data, big data, as just oil, as exhaust, it's just there. But there's no thing that is just there. Even physical nature has to be constructed and configured in a way so we can get value out of it, and the same is true of human life. We have to be configured in such a way that we can be in generative data relations with infrastructures. It's So there is no data that is just there. And that means there has to be a social dimension which is totally absent in Kelly's vision, and it has been since the beginning. That's from his famous New Rules for the New Economy article in 1997, where he described the NED as just a collective interaction spun off of a trillion objects and living beings linked together through air and glass. I think that's still his view today, and the social just isn't even in there in the framing. And that's a big problem. The logic of N equals all, which is the big data logic, therefore has social and ethical costs, which in principle it cannot recognize. So we have to be able to frame the problem in other ways too, which is not to not respect the mathematics and other skills that go into generating the data, because they're extremely important. Okay. What can we do about this? There's a lot of debate about outlawing bad data uses, and that's relatively straightforward in principle, except that one of the solutions is often transparency. And as Helen Nissenbaum points out, machine learning is so complex that we don't know what we there's a limit to what we can see in order to be able to see into machine learning. We can't fully see into it because it is a nonlinear process which acts feeds back on itself in ways that cannot be predicted and can't be seen into. So there may be problems there, but they're not what I want to focus on. Some people talk about the effects of continuous tracking of people, making them feel lacking anxious, lacking in confidence. Just in East Germany before 1989, the life of others. Well, that's a serious worry as well. And there are power relations there, but I don't think it's the fundamental worry. And this is what I want to focus on. For me, the fundamental issue, and it's the one least talked about right now, is the very fact of gathering data itself. That's not to say that all data gathering is bad. Of course, I'm not saying that. But what we're dealing with is moving to a social order which is based primarily on the gathering, the continuous gathering of data from individuals. And the question is this fully compatible with what we think are our values? Or is there a deep tension that we seriously have to take seriously? And I think there is a tension. Let me immediately say there's some type of data collection that we might genuinely want to have, even on that vast scale, in the health area. Many people argue that we simply have to start gathering our health data to deal with serious disease. And I take those arguments really seriously. There are other people argue that it's better to know how one's body is functioning on the micro level, and it's good to have wearables and so on and so forth. I don't dispute that. The question is, what happens when this becomes the norm, even when it even becomes the requirement of insurance companies, employers, friends, and so on? That's a very different social order from where I just choose to understand my body better as I try to run faster. That's a radically different possibility. Even in the health case and voluntary self-tracking, there are major issues about anonymization. The data is formally anonymized, but there's a lot of debate in the health literature as to whether anonymization is actually possible. So even here, even in these special cases, there are worries about data collection. There are even fundamental issues about whether certain data must always be under the control of the individual. The philosopher Daniel Sulmasy argues that the person's genome is so fundamental to who they are and who or what they can be that it must only be under the control of the individual, licensable, if you like, to the wider world. The dangers are so great of allowing it to be in control of anything other than that specific individual. That's an interesting question. That's a sort of fundamental limit, if you like, to data collection and data circulation, which we might think about. So starting to wrap up, there were clearly ethical political tensions developing here. For me, the real contradiction is between the shift to an order based around continuous tracking, which is where we seem to be going, and the notion of freedom or autonomy, which we normally think is at the basis of why we are democracies, why we pride ourselves of being free societies, why we would even want democracy. Without going into any detail, for me, and I've looked for a long time, the only philosophical reference point I found that helps me at all here to get right to the core is Hegel's notion of, he called it freedom, but it's really autonomy, we would say now, which he defined this way, very interestingly. Freedom is the ability to be with oneself in the other. It took me 6 months to understand that, so let me give you a shortcut. He gets absolutely, at the beginning of the 19th century, that identity is relational. Freedom is relational. It emerges in social relations. There's a material infrastructure. That could include some data collection. That's in the other. But that necessity to be with oneself, to be, have the ability to reflect continuously in one's life about where one is going, what one's done wrong, where what one's life means, in dialogue continuously with others. But always it being one's own reflection. No other entity listening in at every point or directing that reflection. That, for him, is the core of what human beings are. That is the autos, the self. Autos, the Greek word. That is the thing whose freedom we're talking about. So what we're talking about here is not a danger for a certain capacity or dimension. We're talking about the very possibility of being a self. And that, for me, is what's at stake if we go without any qualification or debate down the path of continuous tracking. And that's why I'm worried about it. There's biology here. Even not very complex animals, worms and so on, need a certain space, which they defend. European data law is very much related to this. Julie Cohen has written about this. I won't allow time for questions, so I'll just leave that question hanging and say what I've done so far. I think we've reached the point where we have big problems about the production of social knowledge and the condition of that production, which creates tensions with core values, such as freedom and autonomy, which we simply have to start debating. And that means thinking about all of this as a social process, which we are involved in as social beings. We have a voice in this. It is really important, therefore, that we bring together those who produce social knowledge validly, smartly, importantly, with those, any of us, it could include all of us in this room and anyone, who's interested in what the cost of that, the externalities, if you like, might be when transposed to the full social scale and accumulated over time, over decades. That's the issue, and I think we need to be debating it. Ways forward, the law is obviously one very important way. The European General Data Protection Law regulations is very interesting because it actually starts from human rights. But as Kate Crawford and colleagues writing out of Microsoft New Law Lab made a very interesting point, you can have the best legal framework you want, but if it operates in a field of force where an insurer or an employer requires you to sign away your data, for perfectly valid conditions of running their employment or selling you an insurance policy, that regulation will not help you. It's not designed to help you. It's not designed to interrupt business. It's designed to induce certain checks. But if the whole push is to quasi-enforce the giving up of data, then it won't help us. So we have to think about other things. In the health sector, Barbara Evans, one of the most brilliant legal theorists in the health sector, talks about getting together. This relates to Glenn's work. Seriously having a collective conversation about a different data collection infrastructure that would help us bring the problems to the foreground, to talk about them, and try and find collective solutions to deal with these worries. I think that's a really interesting example from the health sector. But she doesn't come up with solutions. She just proposes it as a possibility. It's not easy. And finally, I think, and I draw this partly from Julie Cohen's work, we do have to, without in any way challenging the validity of collecting data and using it to provide smart solutions, we have to raise the philosophical question, as I've said before, that the principle of N equals all, which is valid and interesting mathematically, must at some point cut across our ethical limits and say, no, you will not have that data. You must not collect that data. Because if you collect that, you damage the integrity of what I am and what you are. And that's why I think it's an interesting problem that we just got to think about a lot more. So thank you for listening. Sorry I waxed lyrical, went on slightly beyond my time, but I hope we have time for questions and don't have to finish exactly at 5. That's that. In case you want to go back to the slide.
So we should have 10 more minutes for questions, but of course we will take your time.
Sorry, I have so much to say.
But I'll let you steer your key.
Cool. Ben.
So a lot of your discussion made me think of F.A. Hyatt's sort of discussion of the problems of statistics. So he has this vision in which, like, the problem with statistics, or the attempt to centrally organize an economy using statistics, is that statistics are these aggregate coarse things that don't pick up the particularity of individual situations, and that the beauty of the market, allegedly, is that it delegates to, quote, the man on the spot, who has this much more granular data. It seems like if you substitute the word market there for sort of the autonomous free society or something like that, then the idea is that once you start getting that granularity collected in this automated way, either individual selves get delocalized, they have some identity that is not related to their local surroundings and the role that plays in society, or they sort of disappear entirely, which was sort of what you were pointing towards. So I sort of, maybe that's not even really a question, but it's just an interesting self-reflection.
Well, I think it is interesting because it, first of all, because it zeroes in on the fundamental question here, which is about what is it to know the social world, and Hyatt, that was one of the things that drove his work, the puzzles about, obviously that's extremely interesting, and clearly I'm not suggesting for one moment that somehow statistics offer better knowledge of the social compared with what we have today. I'm just looking at the social externalities, the costs of this model, and that's where my focus is. There are many arguments to say that we will understand, if we go down entirely this model, many aspects of the social better than before, and that's what psychology is being driven by today and so on. That incidentally is why I find those who work, for example, with B.J. Fogg at Stanford, who've been through the very smartest learning of what you can do with analytics to predict behavior with extraordinary precision, are the ones particularly troubled by where this is leading. That already puts one on the sign there is more to debate here. But this is the question of the future of the self. Well, of course, that's a great point. I have no idea where this is heading. I think Kevin Kelly implies in his writing that we should slough off this rather 18th, 19th century sense of our particular individuality. It came out of a certain phase of the Enlightenment, possessive individualism, and so on and so forth, and move to a different phase. Jeremy Rifkin at Wharton Business School has made a similar argument in his Zero Cost Sum Society, whatever the title of his book is, said that privacy is literally an 18th century notion. We should just get over it. But this, of course, ignores the deep, almost a cultural core of privacy to notion. Culture varies, of course. Privacy varies continuously, of course. So does autonomy, our sense of what it is to be autonomous. But as I said, you only have to go to relatively simple or complex animals, and they, unless they are swarm animals, which is a different case, will defend a space around the self from where the environment begins. That is the space of that entity. We're talking, if you like, about that. I think that at the core of all the discussions of privacy, autonomy, with all their confusions and messiness, which is a problem, there's a certain minimal notion of the integrity of the self, which I would defy anyone to say we can dispense with and still be a self. It's true we can move into a collective being, but I have yet to meet anyone who actually wants that. When we think about the costs, we could have the debate, and in a sense one can't debate it. It will be a fundamental phase shift in humanity. But I don't think we're at least ready to get there yet, even if we tell we so. Yes, good to see you.
Listening to you, it's a very dystopian view of a history where humans created business. You know, at first they were bakeries and little mom and pop businesses, and they served us. and they grew and they grew, and then they turned into contemporary corporations. And what we're seeing is sort of the takeover of human autonomy by the world of business. It feels like fundamentally it's not simply an issue around surveillance per se, but that this is, you know, when you talk about it being private entities as opposed to like the government that's at least ostensibly doing it for the public, that these are these private entities that our society has given birth to,
yeah,
that are turning on the people and sort of devouring humans.
That's not what I was saying at
no,
all.
No, it's, but it's a feeling that comes out a little bit in this
happy to respond.
Of the private, of surveillance of the private. And when you talk about the way forward, I think an interesting way of thinking about it is to look at what are some of the big problems we want solved.
Yeah.
So, you know, an obvious one you mentioned is health, which says, well,
sure,
maybe if insurance agencies are collecting all of this data, they have to use that data for health. And to look bigger both at issues around what is it that we want to see into these increasingly opaque entities and institutions, because very little of this is about turning the observing eye into other things. So if you, for instance, think about the environment, or think about how different the unforeseen consequences of the way that money that is given to support certain types of farms has ended up having all kinds of consequences we don't want, is how do we use this type of data to better understand these institutions that have grown extremely opaque and focus on the kind of big challenges that may involve data, but it's not necessarily data about.
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm glad you asked that, because of course I tried to make it clear, but I'm not against data collection. I'm not against data processing. I said that a few times. That's not a problem. It's a new capacity that we have that we need to nurture and think about. What I'm raising is a question, which is that if I'm right, or even half right, that there's a difference in the overall social deal, if you like, through which knowledge of the world is now being generated, compared with a valid comparison of the 19th, 20th century, which is simply about a question of where it goes on, the sorts of purposes for which data is controlled, and how far those are fully open for debate, visible, and so on, and whether the process... That's all I was saying. There's no sense was an anti-business track, because... yeah. Of course, I was making an emphasis rhetorically to try and get our attention, but I think you're right, solving... Can I just come back to that? Because you're right, clearly... The big data could be turned to solve certain problems, which we all want to solve in ways that could be fully accountable and useful, and that would be wonderful. I'm just saying we're not yet at the position to have the social architecture to deal with the possible externalities of the data collection and the data processing. That's the question I'm raising. Those externalities are fundamental and deep.
And I guess the other point I just want to emphasize is that we're sort of assuming that the subject of the surveillance is always humans.
Oh, no, sure.
Thinking more that there's a lot of opaque entities that maybe we could bring a lot more surveillance.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I wasn't saying surveillance of non-human subjects or other entities was a problem. I was focusing on the human problem because I think that's where we start from. But thank you. Now there are lots of... I'd better wrap a few together and then try and...
Talk. I was kind of struck by how, until you had this exchange with Glenn, that the word privacy wasn't too much in here, because it seems like a lot of these social problems we usually put in the privacy bucket. But they're, I mean, especially after like the Equifax hack, when most American social security numbers are now public in some form, like it doesn't seem that people get very upset about privacy. So I thought there was something very productive about moving to the language of freedom instead. So could you talk a little bit about the move from privacy to freedom, like what's driving that?
Yeah, I'll take a few together and then,
This one's actually related to that. It's a question sort of about comparison. And in the first place, it was interesting to me that you mentioned it was useful to compare big data to an older moment of statistical sort of expansion. And you pointed out, you know, there are similarities and differences, and you sort of wonder, why compare to that moment in time and not to something else? Because that moment in time, you know, okay, there's scale, there's numbers, and that sort of thing, but there's not continuity, there's not the things that you mentioned that are different. But you might find other comparisons that might give you those things that are not there in stats, but not do something else. And so one comparison you might do because you mentioned fog, is behaviorism.
Aye.
And the people who are doing this kind of, like, you know, fog behavior design kind of thing, and what Tristan Harris is talking about is like a critique or advocacy for a kind of behaviorist thing. It's not exactly the same as behaviorism. There are similarities and differences again, but it does bring you back specifically to the question of freedom, because it seemed to me like it wasn't clear to me why continuous tracking actually was a threat to autonomy. I imagine that if you ask a lot of the people who advocate for it now, they say, no, it's not necessarily that at all. It's potentially empowering.
No, sure.
And the link maybe to the threat to autonomy comes via
Skinner
this sort of like Skinner box notion of the social. And that might be a sort of connection that needs
maybe.
To happen.
Okay, these are great questions. I'll take a few together. Yeah, Ian.
I think it's related to this as well. I was thinking sort of similar questions about sort of what's different now that we have big data, right? And what is this category in relation to some of the ways social knowledge was produced before there was data and still being produced now? Because I'm thinking, you said, well, data is continuous. I thought, well, that's interesting, because actually it's not. I mean, that's what's funny about data is you take it a chunk here, you take a chunk here, and it's not like life at all that way. And I said, what's another way to think about social knowledge? And that, well, like live performance, things happening in the now. And I think a lot about music. And music is certainly a form of social knowledge and a way of understanding order, of experiencing certain tensions and collaborations. And that's, like that goes on, right?
Yeah.
So there are these forms of knowledge that go on, and you learn about the world, and it creates a sense of order. And now you have big data, but then what's the relationship between the two? Is now big data more important somehow than these other? I was also thinking of gossip. I mean, gossip is exactly this exposure of knowledge that's supposed to be private and has this interesting reverse power potential, and that still goes on today. So that's why I'm with you on the big data, but I'm like, what about all the other stuff and what's
point.
The relation between those two then?
Great point. Shall I take those three and then, that's a great, let me see. Privacy, that's quite deliberate. I didn't mention the word privacy because there's no clear resolution yet about how we reconfigure the concept of privacy to fit this massive reconfiguration of social knowledge gathering. And this is a big problem. Julie Cohen's been writing about it, Mireille Hildebrand in Holland and others. Therefore, all those writers are trying to get underneath the concept of privacy something deeper that might enable us to reconfigure it. Because old, if you like, 19th century liberal privacy about here's your garden, no one can enter your garden, it's just absurd. They're already in your garden, they are in your plants and so on, that's absurd. So we have to have a totally different thinking of what privacy is. And we need to dig down to deeper values, and autonomy is one. Hegel happens to call it freedom, but he means what we mean by autonomy. Even though that word is itself a bit problematic because the idea of the law in there. But when you get to how Hegel describes it, he doesn't mean the private, the liberal individual subject at all. He means something radically different, profoundly relational. So that's why I think it's helpful. So yes, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. From there, we can move back to privacy, and that's what people like Cohen in legal theory are trying to do. The question of comparison, that's great. I mean, I write about behaviorism in another part of the book, so that is interesting. And another part of the argument that I didn't give you have a chance to fill in here is whether there's been a long move in the 20th century, which is very different from the 19th century move around statistics, to thin out our sense of the social subject quite radically. Behaviorism was part of that. Revived behaviorism could be seen as part of that. Some talk about big data, like Chris Anderson's notorious article, The End of Theory, is very emphatically about thinning out the human subject and saying, we just don't need to know about any of that squishy stuff. That is now, clearly those are almost self-parodying positions, but they're pretty influential. And there were some people who argue that within neuroeconomics and there's some versions of that, there are certain tendencies. Now, I'm not going to claim to pronounce on neuroeconomics because it's a complex area, but some more of that is in the book. I just felt the largest comparison one can make to get a sense of where we are on the social level is the 19th century. So that was why I presented it for you. Now, Ian's very interesting point. You're right about continuity. I mean continuity of the collection in time. But behind that there's a very complex question, which is really interesting, which is that data to count regularly across space has to generate continuities at the level of calculation and comparison, which are not there in the raw stuff that is made into data. Now, that's a deep point about what data does and what it should do. So that's that means there are all sorts of areas of life which don't really fit so well into that. Nancy writes about the use of the marvelous aspects of how music, and I used to be a musician, is enhanced by social networking profoundly. I wish I'd been a musician today. It's just a much better and easier life to connect in various ways. It's extremely interesting. However, I think there is a real issue about what cannot be included in this type of knowledge. My co-writer, Ulysses Mejias, has written about the paranodal, as he calls it, the raw stuff of life that lies around the node that by definition cannot be put into data and therefore is literally not just invisible, it simply isn't there for counting. That's a really big question about how the social is being transformed. And that then leads to a point that everything in the end comes down, and this is why we need historical comparison, to what can be said about the social. If the aspects of life which we just are in and live aren't registered in the general narratives that are available to be told about the social, there's a certain dislocation. Maybe a very important. There's always dislocation to some degree, but that's, I think, an area of interest, and that's where I'm working in other aspects of the book, so thanks for raising that. But there were more questions, so I need to go faster. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the materiality of the data.
Yeah.
You didn't mention archiving or the permanence of the data at all in your conversation. And the reason I wanted to ask about that is because one of the things I think that's different about the big data today is that it purports a fixedness in time of any one moment or person. That seems to very much push against the Hegelian notion of autonomy, that you can be many people at one time, but the fixedness of data assumes that you are only one person at one time, and that limits freedom, autonomy, whatever we want to call it. And so can you say something about materiality?
That's a great point. There was another one. Did you have Todd?
Yeah.
Try and take one or two more.
Yeah, the question I thought I needed to ask was, you have a concern about the ethics of data collection, and you sometimes talk about private data collection or private capacity of data collection. There's also continued state collection. There's also, say, something like social scientific academic work. So I was going to ask you, are you focusing on the private one because it's the most pressing, or do you think the problems are universal? But now I want to adjust the question a little bit based on what Ian was asking, because that makes me think maybe what you're interested in is the institutional production of social knowledge. And maybe there's a whole set of questions about other forms of social knowledge that aren't always in the hands of, they're in certain hands and not others. Like, you know, Microsoft's talking all about, like, democratizing AI.
Yeah.
But I think they're just gonna hold on to the mechanism for doing it and democratize and get to pay for its results. Right? So, like, I'm still not in a position where I can do big data collection.
No.
But I can't produce music or narrative.
Right.
So is it the sort of, like, the pressure of this very particular institutional form of social knowledge production that's coming in these places, the kind of institutions that can do it at scale, and then it's like available and not, but it's also felt and not. So I guess I'm more interested in like...
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Just going back to the previous one about memory, I did mention in passing, I was going so much to say in 30 minutes, yes, clearly that's very important, which is that because data is archived, it's stored with a stamp, as it were, of the particularity of the moment, and could be reused again at a later time, maybe in a very different context. This creates all these problems of contextual integrity that Helen Nissenbaum writes about. That's fundamental. Now, you could certainly argue that the result of that is to interfere with the sort of temporal integrity of the self. And that's another layer of problem, which I think is important. I mean, everyone remembers, I'm sure, that truly gut-wrenching moment when Facebook, at the end of a person's year, sent to a father who happened to be a techie the picture of his daughter who died that year, saying, any relations with this person? He wrote a wonderfully eloquent blog called Algorithmic Cruelty, which was gut-wrenching because he understood exactly how it had happened. But he also felt pained. in the deepest possible sense, this is absolutely wrong, and yet it's generated by processes I understand. So I think you're right, when we move on to the temporal side, there are even more issues about the question of integrity. I think that, for me, that reinforces the argument, or, unless you think we gradually become used to this change. But I think we absolutely do not become used to these changes, and that's a sort of simple, crude example. So I'm sure there's more we could talk about, but thank you for raising the time question. Tarleton, that's a great point. I'm using the word public-private here simply to signal a different assemblage of knowledge, authority, trust, and so on, which is therefore relatively crude. And that doesn't necessarily map on to certain types of institutions simply. And the state, of course, remains profoundly interested in private data collection. I mean, you may not know, but in Britain, the British government seriously debated about 4 or 5 years ago, until something stopped it, it's not clear what, abandoning the national census. About 5 years ago, there was a small debate about that, on the basis that far better data was being gathered all the time by private organizations. The state was running out of money. Why not just defer that fundamental faculty of the state, which is to know its population in order to govern? So I think there are very interesting relations between the state and private, which raise massive political theory questions. But you're implying the question which goes back to Glenn's, which I think is a really serious point. Well, couldn't we imagine that with a different assemblage, a different configuration of authority, trust, and so on, we could consent to more data being gathered about ourselves and to being stored? I don't deny that for a moment. That's why I pointedly mentioned the health case. But that will require a very different social architecture from what we have at the moment. I know it's the sort of thing that Glenn is exactly interested in. But I think I'm trying to point out these are extremely difficult questions to generate such a social architecture. It's never been done in the past. It's only been done by states which did not successfully generate trust. We don't barely know how to solve that higher dimensional interdependence problem. So I'm exposing the problem. Yes, it will be great if we have better solutions, because we're not going to stop data collection. And I would love it to be put to more positive thing. But I think we're barely at the beginning of even posing the question, let alone solving it.
Struck by often when I'm having just the day-to-day conversations about collecting data, it's less of a N equals all and more of an N of everything I can get.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Precisely the interest in getting what I can without the possibility of the disruption of requesting consent, because that might impinge on either the representatives, my sample, but then this really odd disconnect. I don't know if it's a disconnect. What do you make of the willingness to say, well, I'll work with what I can get, and I'm going to extrapolate out from there? Mm. It's not as though I've ever talked with any engineer in this area that said, what we really need is a sensor on every person, every baby, every second. None of them feel like that's necessary, precisely because they imagine that what they're working out is a new statistics to extrapolate and project.
In fact, the people who say that are the computational social scientists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, who have the vision of what if everybody was a dictator.
Yeah, there's no engineer who feels like that's necessary, and I think it perhaps goes back to your diagnosis of a certain set of assumptions about the natural state of the human being.
Yeah.
So what do you make of that
well,
way of thinking about the end?
Well, that's obviously very encouraging, that in other words, implicitly, there is resistance. I'm not claiming any special. There's a sort of resistance here.
Resistance, as it's like, seen as unnecessary.
Yeah.
Like, well, literally, like, well, I don't really need a sensor on every baby. I just
right. But
the babies that I can get to. I mean, like, if you suggest.
Yeah, I mean, and that.
We can refer.
And that, of course, is the older model of building statistical knowledge, which didn't raise this sort of externality problem that I'm talking about. But I think the picture looks rather differently if you go study how marketers are talking about the gathering information. Their business model is about gathering all information at all times and hoping to use it. For example, there's an interesting report on the future of wearables by PricewaterhouseCooper, came out 3 or 4 years ago, and Joe Turow talks about in his book on the shopping mall and surveillance. which seriously, without irony or humor, suggested, well, if everyone started to have a wearable built in, which was continuously tracking the state of their body and continuously being matched with all the available marketing information about what they like and what they don't, they could be told, well, you're sweaty now. Maybe you should get a bottle of water, but we know you like that store around the corner, but they're offering a special deal, and so on. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is the core conception, which has some spurious basis in certain stories about big data. To be more explicit, this is not good science. It's a certain story that Anderson and others have told. And certain very, very practical fixes in the marketing world, which are working to install the possibility of N equals all as a default setting. McKinsey's have written reports arguing that we need that default setting of assuming the data will be collected. That, I think, raises questions.
Yes, sir. You should go ahead. I already said something. Oh, please, go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned marketing. So in the spaces that I study where this proposition of data collection is always present, it's very much embedded in marketing and advertising.
Yeah.
But it often still feels as if it's a, well, there's two things that I think of. There's this fabulous stuff on peak ads, right, that we sort of have already hit the moment where this, the promise of advertising and marketing is, it's not, there's a rhetoric of it, a mythos of it, but it's not where things really are. And so the big data stuff is participating in a rhetoric that is, really needs to be revisited. And so I I'm glad you mentioned the marketing, because I do wonder how we make sense of these tensions that sort of drive to revive a marketing and advertising model that actually has a lot of empirical fragility to it that many people actually in the space know.
Sure.
And are kind of...
Well, so I mean, again, you're pointing to the fact that there are complex cultural tensions being worked out, and that's good. And that's as we would expect if this is a social process. But I can't deny it. I've been very struck by Joseph Thoreau's account of the retail marketing area, which doesn't see the type of resistance and drawback that you're talking about. It may be different in different sectors. Clearly the picture is still emerging, and I'm trying to draw a general narrative out of this and say that if we were to continue entirely in this direction, there will be these major consequences, hence my alarm bell. But I'm glad to hear that. And music might be a special case, I don't know, that's quite... Or the game industry might be very interesting. We should talk more about that.
Yeah. The big data stuff is trying to animate something people know is deeply crumbling under their feet.
Right, got
it.
Well, we should talk more, and I hope you're right, but if you look, I've also been doing a study of the big discourse about big data collection from World Economic Forum, the leading spokes organizations for business, global business, and they're not making any concessions at all in their language about this, and their reports have some weight, and so that's another of my sources lying behind the report, but it's luckily a complex picture, more complex than I painted to foreground the questions. Glenn, did you want to come back and say?
I guess it just seems to me there's an important distinction that was coming up in what you were describing between the way in which data is used and what data is collected.
Yeah.
And both pose, it seems to me, different threats to the concept of autonomy.
Yeah.
So one mode is data is collected, and simply the fact that it gets surfaced in various ways in social contexts undermines my control or my relationship to how I'm perceived socially, understood by other people, and what I'm able to do on my own because of how it will be perceived by others. That's sort of one set of issues. And that seems to raise issues about you have to have humility because otherwise you get coerced to share things in the ways that you're describing and so forth. But there's another set of issues where actually it's the recommendations that are coming back to me and my willingness to accept those, and the power of what's being offered to me, that's actually the threat to autonomy. And
yes.
The erosion of the individual's real authority over her own choices. And those seem to me actually to be two somewhat separate things, which are both threatening different aspects of autonomy.
This is great. I mean, autonomy is, once you start to open it out and rework with it from now, is a very complex concept that we need to fill in lots of new ways. So I wouldn't disagree with that for a moment. I think they're actually directly connected, though, because Hegel's view, and this is why I find it so compelling, is that there never was a final stability of the self. It's endlessly changing in mutual relations with others, but while still trying to go on making sense of itself. So as you say, the recommendations we receive from others that we integrate into our sense of ourselves are really crucial to that. Now, I've been reading today, and discussing in another reading group over at Berkman tomorrow, is the Karen Jung piece on the hyper-nudge. And anyway, it's quite a new piece by a legal theorist at King's College London, taking the simple liberal notion of the nudge, relatively innocent, why not encourage people to eat slightly more healthily or whatever it might be by placing things differently, sure, which in itself is not in any way offensive to liberal principles, although it's been debated, with the hyper-nudge, which is installing nudging at almost every point in a million-point space. So at every point the self comes up against, you can immediately see, you start to get the feedback loops I'm talking about. And her argument is that this is in principle necessarily opaque, and therefore it must interfere with that autonomy we thought the subject had to frame its choices about choices, its second-order choices. They are the core. And that is really interesting. So I think the two link together. And that is why I just want to raise the question as to whether continuous data collection as a default or norm doesn't have, and the playbacks that necessarily come from that when we all surveil each other, as of course we do, I do as much as anyone else, create externalities, moral, ethical, practical, and also in terms of social legitimacy for the institutions we need for markets and other things, which we just have to think about. So that's, I'm raising the question.
Okay, join me in thanking you.
Thank you.